This week on the Drag Scene Podcast from the Southeast Gassers Association, Queen Scott joins us to talk old school gasser racing and a whole lot more. So pull those belts tight. Get ready to put in the beams. The Drag Scene Podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Drag Scene Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. This week on the show, we got a treat for you. We got Queen Scott from the Southeast Gasser Association that comes on to talk old school. I'm talking old school drag racing and what the Southeast Gassers do and whatnot. And it's if you're looking to get a true education on where heads up racing actually started and how it came about, this is going to be the show you'll want to listen to. So without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Drag Scene Podcast is Southeast Gassers Association founder Quain Scott. What's going on, Quain?
Hey, man. Great, Brian. Good to hear from you, buddy.
Awesome. Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. Andrew Wolf, my editor, and I have kind of had you circled on our list to bring you on the show at some point because of just everything that you kind of have got going on and kind of your history within the sport. So I'm definitely looking forward to talking some racing with you today.
Yeah, I love talking about the old days of racing. It's just about as much as I do the what's going on now. So we should have a good conversation today.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, I didn't realize this until I started talking with Andrew and doing a little bit of pre-show prep is that, you know, you were pretty a prolific pro mod racer back in your day, right?
Yeah, yep. 19 years. Started in 94. Well, actually, I started before then doing some outlaw pro mod stuff. Quick 8, we used to call it around here. And then I started doing it professionally in 94. I went to my first IHRA pro mod race in 94, and I did it till 2013. And so 19 years I made my living racing pro mod. That was all I did. And thank God for good sponsors. First 2 years I did out of my pocket. And then we ran good enough to pick up sponsorship. But the cool part was I did it out of my pocket for the first 2 years and outrun the guys that had sponsors and the big guys. So that's why, you know, made it more rewarding that way, I guess. And then we worked our way up through it. And 2006, I won the IHRA World Championship. 2001, CarCraft Magazine voted me Driver of the Year. That was probably my most prestigious award because that was voted on by the fans. That wasn't something I won. That was something that, and Lord, I could go on and on with that, but there's a lot of stuff I was really proud of because I loved racing. And pro mod wasn't my dream. My dream was pro stock, but I never could afford that when pro mod came along. I could see that, you know what, I can do this out of my pocket. Because when pro mod first started, that's the way it was. You know, I built everything, and started doing it. Couldn't do that in pro stock at the time. Pro stock, even back then, was a millionaire's game, which is what pro mod has turned into now. But, yeah, had a good run of pro mod, really, really enjoyed it.
Now, to me, that's cool because, you know, I grew up around cars and racing, and, like, to me, you know, pro mod to me is just, like, that ultimate, like, when growing up and watching, it was like the ultimate outlaw wild, wild west show because cars were just, you know, back like you're talking about when they first started kind of rolling out, they were wild. People did not know what to expect and they packed the grandstands just to see what are these guys going to do? You know, what's going to happen? And that, you know, to me, that's what made it so interesting. And from your standpoint, you know, what was it like back in those early days of racing these cars when they were angry beasts?
Brian, you are so right, and I'll touch on a quick subject. They want to bring back a nostalgia pro mod, and I told them, I said, guys, it's impossible. You can't do it, and I'll tell you why. I mean, I'm more power to them, and I'm going to support it, but they're going to have a rough road because when we started running pro mod, we was taking pro stock chassis because that's all we knew. Think about it. Pro stock was the fastest door cars in the world at the time. I called them the fastest cars in the world because to me, a funny car and a dragster is not a car.
Oh, they're not.
Don't even resemble a car. So a pro stock was the fastest cars in the world at the time. Then they had about, I'm going to estimate, 1,500 horsepower. Well, here we come putting 2,100 horsepower engines in the same chassis. these suckers did not have a clue which way they was going to go. And that, you know, I remember that thing bowing up and carrying the left front wheel to the 330 mark and the right front wheel still on the ground, you know, and it'd go left one time and right the next, and you ain't even made no changes because they were overpowered, the chassis, so bad. Plus, we didn't have a clue what we was doing. And the next thing you know, the chassis builders are figuring it out. They're starting to do the bracing the chassis up better. We've started learning shock technology. I think the death blow was a race pack computer. When we started getting the computers and getting the data, we started seeing what was going on. We started seeing the driver's mistakes, shifting in the wrong spot and all that stuff. The car started at some point along there, I'm going to say somewhere around 2000 and maybe one or two, cars started looking like they were on rails. And that's when you started seeing the fans start disappearing. But being involved in that was so cool. We didn't have air shifters. The blown cars didn't have two steps. It was more of a driver's race, and that's why I was able to get into Pro Mod without a lot of money, because it was who could drive the best. Next thing you know, here comes air shifters. I'm just going to hit the high spots, because I remember going to IHRA and I said, please don't do that. Some of us guys that can actually shift these things with the levers, that talent's going to be gone. You just took the talent. Same thing happened to Ronnie Sox in Pro Stock in the 70s when Linko come out. Ronnie had an advantage because he could drive and shift the four-speed better than all the other racers. Well, when Alenco come out, they just took the people that couldn't shift to four-speed and made them equal to the man that could. And that's been the whole thing wrong with racing now. Every time there's somebody that can't do something, especially if it's a rich kid, the sanctioned body will allow some device that makes this kid be able to do it. And I'm like, oh, my God, not time to get on this yet. That's why I started the Gasser deal. I wanted to see some talent back in the sport.
And it's funny you mention that, because, you know, I'll get on these YouTube kicks where I'll go through and start, you know, you start watching one video and then an hour later you're watching different videos. And it's funny you mention that, watching some of the nostalgia Pro Stock drivers and watching those dudes grab gears is just, and what they were do, you know, that's, you know, I drive an automatic transmission in my car because that's what I want to do. But I have mad respect for the guys that can legitimately rip gears in a quarter mile race and do it well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, everything now's got a, even the ones that do have, say, a Linko in it, they've got automatic shifters in them. And yes, automatic transmissions have their place in racing. A man that's going to bracket race would be a fool to put a straight drive in his car. Even in nowadays heads-up racing, my Pro Mod the last 3 years had a torque converter in it instead of a clutch, which stemmed the reason I put rider on the window, because that was the last blow that took me out of the car, you know, at this point. Nothing wrong with a converter, because if a man's racing to make a living, the technology had passed, the clutch technology, and the converter was faster. But if I had been the sanctioning body of NHRA and IHRA, I would have never allowed the converter, even though it was better, to keep some talent in the sport. And,
you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, that kind of go off of that, I was up at the World Cup this year, and Jonathan Adkins reset the I think it was a 6-speed H pattern record. It went like a 750 in, you know, an old LT based, you know, GM engine. And watching him run that car, you almost wouldn't have known that he had a clutch in that car because of how smooth he shifted. And it was awesome to watch, because that car, you know, it was angry. It was rolling out. And that's just cool to see stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I'll break your heart just a little bit. It was definitely a manual transmission, and credit where credit's due, but he was probably clutchless shifting, and which we don't allow in the Gasser world, or in Southeast Gassers. They leave a line with a clutch. Just even Pro Mod, you know, back then the Linkos were clutchless. But they've got these manuals now where all you got to do is yank the stick. Well, just like the Liberty and Pro Stock cars, Pro Stockers now, which pro stocker since the '70s, but not taking nothing away from that, because that is very impressive that somebody can do that with a manual transmission. There's a class here around home local where the only rule is it's got to be a manual. I think it's got a tire size. It's got to be a manual transmission. It's got to be an H pattern shifter. And, that may be what some of that guy you were just talking about stem from.
Yeah, it was. I'm pretty sure he's got a clutch in the car, I think.
He does have a clutch. Yeah, they leave a line with a clutch, but then they shift it without it. In other words, you don't have to depress the clutch to shift it. And I could be wrong. That's something we'll do some research on. But most everything now, even stock eliminator, believe it or not, in NHRA stock eliminator, you're allowed to clutchless shift. If it's a manual transmission, but you don't, they don't have to use a clutch to shift. So, like I said, even something post as pure as stock eliminator, their NHRA is letting them clutchless shift, which makes me sick.
Oh,
now it's got a clutch in it. They leave the line with a clutch, but then all they do is just pull the stick. They don't have to touch clutch anymore.
Oh, I could watch stock and super stock for hours.
I can too. I love it, but I hate to see. I built a super stock car here about 4 years ago. I had a customer wanted me to do him a super stock car. Well, I start in on this thing about like I would have back in the 80s when I was building a bunch of super stock cars. And I get the rule book out and I start looking at it. I said, God dang, this thing, they're allowing coilover shocks, a round tube chassis in the back. I built this car from the seat back pretty much like a modern day pro stocker. And when I quit building super stock cars in 83, 84, we had to have the chassis had to be 2x3. It had to be in the same place the original chassis was. It had to have the spring and shock types that came with the car from the factory. There now, the back half of a super stock car is pretty much pro stocker. And I'm like, dang, they just took away the whole reason for the class, because that's what made it pure. And so, I mean, it just, I guess you get me on modern day racing, I can't quit talking about how I feel like they've just totally screwed it up. But to me, super stock was supposed to be that, super stock. We have a super stock class in Gassers now. We added it last year. Guess what? 7-inch tire, it's got to fit under the fender. You're not allowed to do any cutting. Front suspension's got to be stock. It's got to be a 4-speed, which that's just our little gitch. But we've got a true super stock class now. The cars have to look like they looked in 1967 super stock. No narrowed rear ends, no none of that stuff.
Well,
and it's taking off. Believe me, it's going to do just as well as the Gasser deal does.
You know, let's kind of transition to, you know, to what you do at the Southeast Gassers Association and whatnot, because truth be known, I like anything loud, fast, and dangerous.
Right.
And I after researching this, I realized, you know, just how different your Gasser Association was from a lot of the Gassers that I've seen, which I still, like I said, you know, you go to Good Guys here in Columbus, mm-hmm. and you see that, to me, I use the Good Guys car show here in Columbus as kind of like a kind of barometer for the trends that are coming around in the custom car world.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
What was interesting this year and even last year was the amount of Gasser style builds. I say mm-hmm. style because, you know, they're not
exactly,
they're not,
you said it right.
They're not
yep.
pure to, you know, true-ish Gassers, but just seeing people's takes on those cars was interesting, because you'd see cars that weren't, you know, in that era as a Gasser made into a Gasser. It was kind of wild to see. And then, you know, I got to go to a couple events and see some of these regional and local Gasser cars kind of race, you know. Kind of give us a real quick history lesson on the Gasser for those that, you know, might not know.
You want me to give you a history lesson on the Gasser class itself? I think that's probably where we need to start.
Yeah.
Because it will help explain what we do. So in the 50s, probably the mid-50s, I think it was, 50, 56, Wally Parks with NHRA, founder of NHRA, seen a need for a class where you could do engine transplants. In other words, you could put a Ford Chevrolet in an engine or whatever, because if you think about it, in the 50s, they had the top fuel, they had stock eliminator, they had, I think, modified. They did not have a class where you could do an engine transplant for the young kids or for the working man. Then, you know, if you've all heard the stories back in the day where such and such put a Cadillac motor in his 40 Ford. Well, the people that did that didn't have anywhere to race it. So Wally Parks created a class called gas coupes and sedans. And it, the only real rule it had, well, I'll say this because they were rules. Rule number one was they had to run on gasoline, but it didn't matter which engine was in it. You could put any engine you wanted. So here comes the Willises with the Hemis, you know, to the Anglias with the Hemis, the lightweight cars. The class got interesting real, real fast. And to me, and I've talked to some of the old gasser racers, that's what Pro Mod started like. Same thing. Just like me and you was talking earlier. Some big, god-awful engine in a chassis that won't handle it. So they was exciting to watch.
That just sounds like a good time.
Only imagine how this was. Well, as time went on, in about 1968, they started figuring out. The tracks got better, the tires got better, and all of a sudden the gassers got boring, just like Pro Mod's done, just like Pro Stock. It's the history just repeats itself over and over and over. And I noticed all this. I wasn't old enough. I was living, and I went to see gassers, but I was just a kid. But I look back at the history, and I watched what happened to Pro Mod, and I watched the same thing happen. I read about the same thing happening to the gassers. So it got boring because people figured out how to make it better. Well, what I had to do was capture that time before it got better. That's why there's 22 pages of strict rules. I have people tell me all the time, said, why don't you just take the 1967 rule book and use it? You know you can take the 1967 gasser rule book and build a modern-day Pro Stocker, because it didn't tell you you couldn't run a 16-wide tire. It didn't tell you you couldn't run a fuel injection. It didn't tell you you couldn't have a strut front, because none of that existed. So the rule book was like a page long in 1967. Like I said, it had to be a car body. You had to run gasoline. You could put any engine you wanted in it. Didn't matter what manufacturers. And so I had to capture that. None of the other nostalgic people are trying to do that. When you said you see gassers, you're now seeing some car that some guy has jacked up in the front. The first thing they do is go buy a moon gas tank and stick it out just as far as they can the nose of it. It's like they start doing these crazy paint jobs that they didn't have back then. You believe this or not, find me one single picture from 1965 where a gasser had flames on it. You won't be able to do it. They didn't do it. I don't know why. To this day, I cannot figure out why, because flames were popular back then. But I can't find a picture nowhere of a real gasser that was NHRA legal. Well, now every gasser you see has got flames painted on it. We don't allow it. It's in my rule book, no flames. When we try to take the fans back to 1967, I don't like the patina, because gassers didn't have patina back then. I'm not trying to take you back to 2009. I'm not trying to take you to a gasser race in 2019. I'm trying to take you to 1967. We're walking in a time tunnel. A 64 Falcon with rust holes in it didn't exist in 1964 because it was only in 1967 because it was only 3 years old. So we don't want. I have a few cars that are like that, but we're badgering them to get them painted because we want the cars to look like they would have looked. People was proud of their cars. Yeah, they was primered and whatnot at times, but they was paint jobs on the way. And I've got totally off subject here, like I told you I'd do.
Oh no, it's awesome to hear because you can hear your passion about it.
Oh yeah, I'm so passionate about it. And I told you earlier when we was talking before the interview started, drag racing was good to me. I made a lot of money. I had good sponsors in my 19 years of pro mod. I really made a lot of good money. I at one time had two cars. Well, several times, and the money I made, I look back when I parked the Pro Mod in 2013. I started this in 2011. I wanted to give something back to the sport because it had been so good to me. So the best way to give something back is preserve history. So I start looking around, you know, the best way to do it. And I said, well, you know, what's getting the most attention? What's getting put down the worst? And I looked at the Gasters, and I said, Lord, this ain't nothing like what they did. This spoke front wheel deal, this blows my mind. I know you've seen this fake spoke front wheel that somebody's making. Well, guess what? Gasters didn't run that wheel. If you look in the 1965 Gasser NHRA rulebook, they had to have four-wheel brakes. That wheel in the 60s was a spindle mount wheel, which did not accept brakes. You've seen that wheel on Altereds. You've seen that wheel on dragsters and funny cars, but that 12-spoke wheel was not on a legal NHRA Gasser. Now, some companies made this wheel, and they call it a Gasser wheel. Every Gasser, every newcomer that's building a Gasser, I call them the uninformed, they go buy that wheel and put them on it. And the companies had to make millions. But they used the Gasser name. So that's what got me started. I said, I've got to try to protect the Gasser name before nothing's left of it. And so that's where I started. I'll give you an example, the word Nitro. Same thing's happening to the Gasser name. If you think back, and let's just say 15 years ago, the word Nitro meant something. It meant, NHRA uses advertiser top fuel classes. When you heard Nitro, you thought about a fire-breathing, belching, top-fuel funny car coming down the racetrack. And NHRA would say, Nitro funny car coming to Atlanta Dragway this weekend. Everybody piled out to see them. Well, next thing you know, this name gets so popular, everybody starts using it as an advertising gimmick. All of a sudden, these Nitro candy bars, Nitro soft drinks, Nitro tennis shoes. Now NHRA can't even use the name anymore because it don't mean nothing. It don't have that ring to it anymore. Well, the same thing is happening to the Gasser name. Everything in the world is now called a Gasser. And like I said, this company has made millions off of this wheel, calling it a Gasser wheel, when it's really not even a Gasser wheel. So I feel like I'm trying my best to get the people to see what Gassers were. And we're not perfect by no stretch of the imagination. We are actually probably way off, but we're the closest you're going to get to taking you back to that time. And some people, you know, we don't allow automatic transmissions. That don't mean the Gassers didn't have automatics back then, because some of them did. Matter of fact, most of you blown Gassers did. But back then, automatic was exciting because the tracks were junk. So the automatic still skated around and spun around. You put automatic in a Gasser now, something with 800 horsepower, well, that thing's the boringest thing in the world. Even with the old school suspension, they still wouldn't go right down a racetrack, just slick as a button, no moving around, no doing, oh yeah, they'll do the big wheelies, leaving the starting line. But it's the wrong kind of wheelie. If you look at it, it's one of those fluid wheelies instead of jerking the wheels up like the Gassers did in the day. You know, it's a big difference in a wheelie with an automatic car and a wheelie in a stick car.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because an automatic car's got this real nice fluid motion, which is why that converter's so much faster, because it's so much smoother. A stick car, when it picks the front wheels up, it yanks them up and just jerks. It's just, even in the car, you can just feel the violence of it.
We've done track rentals here in Columbus, one of the columbusracing.com I help run. And we've had a guy that had a period correct Anglia Gasser that would come out, blower with a four speed, and mm-hmm. everybody would stop what they were doing when this car would come up because we wanted to see what it was going to do.
And which way it's going to go.
the only time it went straight was when his foot was not pressing down the loud pedal.
And Brian, listening to what you just said, you just described two eras. you described the gasser, and you described the early pro mod cars. And what did both of those things have in common? The bleachers were full.
Oh, this was just a track rental with like 100 guys, and we would all be like,
hear
that thing fire up, we're like, oh, this is going to be cool. And I remember one time that dude let off that clutch, and that thing made a beeline for the wall. He never lifted. All he did was grab second gear to try to bring that nose down. I mean, that car was dancing all over the track, and the dude never lifted. I remember I turned around and looked at my buddy and said, how did he not wad that car up? With as big of a move as that thing made, I mean, that took, you know, that takes a lot of skill to keep a car, like, it from not hitting the wall and knowing, you know, how to drive something like that. To me, that's what makes kind of the nostalgia stuff cool. And kind of, you know, we'll kind of take a sidestep away from the gassers for a second. I want to get your take on something.
Okay.
Something that I like that I thought was cool. I saw these a couple years ago at a show, the Racing Performance Show up in Chicago. Like nostalgia pro stock cars, you know, true nostalgia pro stock cars. I've got to see them make hits. You know,
what if you say true nostalgia, I go along with you.
Yeah, like the ones that I've seen make hits were like still had the four speeds in them and stuff like that. I mean, doing the dry hops, the whole deal.
I love it. Yep.
Would that be something that you would try to maybe bring in as a little bit of a sideshow to your deal? Since that's
no.
they get more popular.
Would they're doing okay. I wouldn't bring it in as a sideshow because remember I'm taking you back to 1967. We've had offers of, you would not believe, some cool, really cool stuff to come into our show. But one little small detail of anything that's out of 67 era would take my fans somewhere I don't want them to go. Another thing, I don't always tell this, but I'll give you a scoop. Another thing I figured out is our A-gas cars, our cars are not that fast. They run like, I'll go ahead and say it, our record's a 547 in the 8 mile. So that's not a super fast car. That's 2 seconds slower than my Pro Mod was. But when you don't have nothing else there all day, the fans get a perspective of that, and it looks fast. You could bring in one Nostalgia Pro Stock car and let it run, I don't know what they run, 470s, 490s, whatever. And now the whole rest of the day, the gassers look slow. That's part of being a promoter, is you got to learn how to, these little things that keep the fans on their feet all day. So I will never, ever bring in anything faster than my A-gas cars.
Okay.
Because of that. Now, the other side of that is I would never bring in anything that's out of the 67 era. When we started the super stock class, we would have been way better off if we'd have moved it on to like 1972 or maybe 70 even. But we couldn't do that because now we would have to move our era up to 1970, and the gassers died in 68. We don't want anything to do with gassers after 1967 because by 1968 the gasser class was dead. Nobody cared anything about it. Funny cars had took over by then. So if you see what I'm saying, the Nostalgia Pro Stock, but the Nostalgia Pro Stock thing is going to struggle because they already started bracket racing them. They've already started letting them have automatics. I seen one the other day, it's supposed to be a replica of somebody's car from 1976 or 77, and it had a wheelie bar 8 foot long hanging out the back of it. So whoever's making the rules is already killing it. They're going to kill it. And another thing that's going to kill it is there's too many different classes. I mean, like you got like six or seven of them fighting among themselves, and nobody's making the same rules. And that's what the same thing happened to GAP. There's like 35 other gasser groups in the country. 35. But guess what? There's only one. It has, you know, we're the only gasser group, period, in the world that requires them to run gasoline. That should be, like I told you from the start, that was rule number one. They had to run gasoline.
Well,
99%, especially the blown stuff, 100% of the blown stuff is all running alcohol.
I think where a lot of that comes from is, you know, like you talked about, you know, being a promoter, and I think it's where a lot of the promoters are trying to have car counts, which I totally get makes
exactly.
sense.
Exactly. You know, that's exactly what it's for. You're 100% right.
You know, and, you know, I'm all about, you know, if you're doing something racing related, I'm cool with that. Just me personally, because I think it's important, like you said, to, you know, to keep bringing people in and, you know, you keep things active and, you know, cars going down any track is a good thing because that's money flowing into the, into the coffers. But at the same time, I can see where, you know, kind of where your organization is coming from, where, you know, you're keeping it pure, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's almost like a, it's a very interesting thing that we could draw between, you know, that idea. And then when you see on the, you know, on the interwebs and social media where people are constantly fighting about rules, and it puts, I think, modern promoters and racing organizations in a jam because they've got to balance so much trying to keep racers happy, keep sponsors happy, keep fans in there that it can kind of like muddy the waters quickly. And then, you know, are the inmates, the racers running the prison? You know, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to do here? You know, it can make it difficult to keep things in check.
Our slogan is we want quality, not quantity. And that keeps us from changing. My rules, we're fixing new rule revisions right now, and they're getting even stricter for 2020. They've got stricter every year. And because without that, I'm going to fall back in the same trap the other 35 gasser groups are. And you hit the nail on the head. They, every one started out with the same intentions I had. Every one of them. But they soon found, well, we ain't got but four cars coming. We can't put on a race with four cars. Well, I did. I put on a race with four cars for the first, well, actually two the first year. And we went and did match racing, and we tagged along to a bracket race. I'd call tracks, and I'd say, hey, man, we got two old school gassers. We don't care nothing about that. I said, come on, man, give me a chance. Let me come. Well, next thing I know, I got people saying, hey, what do we got? Or, well, first thing I get is I got people calling me, hey, man, I got a gasser too. I say, send me pictures of it. And I said, no, sorry, pal, because we raced first to finish line. So you have to have very strict rules. We got some very, very strict performance rules that go along with our very, very strict error correct rules. So these people that want to come race with us, I said, no, sorry, you're going to have to fix this, this, and this, and this if you want to come race with us. Well, they seen that by this time the tracks are begging us to come because we were bringing in the fence. Just like you said, with just two of us there, the fence would line up with the racers and the crew because there weren't no spectators. You know, at bracket races does not draw spectators, period. That's not even the track operators tell you that quickly. But the track operators seen this, well, then they go tell their buddies. Next thing you know, we got 300 or 400 spectators at a race. Track operators like, huh, I don't never have spectators. This is pretty cool. We're going to have y'all back. Well, these people that wanted to race with us seen that. So finally somebody says, you know what, I'm going to fix my car so I can go race with Quain and them guys. We didn't even have it named at the time. Everybody called it Quain's Gassers. I was still running Pro Mod and doing this for a sideline. Next thing we know, we got 12 cars. Next thing we know, we got 20 cars. Our last race, we had 80 cars. The race before that, we had 81. Had 112 different cars race with us this year because I stuck with what I said I was starting with. I could have very easily changed the rules that first year or that second year and had 50 cars. So what would I have had? I'd have had a bunch of stuff out there that just randomly run. Then you can't make classes and run them heads up, so you got to put some kind of index on it or power them up by ET. We don't even show the scoreboards. The clocks might as well be turned off because we don't need that. The power can go off, and we still have a drag race and determine the winner at the end of the day. We'd have to flag start them. But the point is, the gasser name was getting destroyed, and we just come here and tried to fix it. And I think I got off of the NHRA Pro Stock thing. That's what these guys are having to do. They keep slacking up the rules to get more cars. Well, next thing you know, they start wondering, where'd the spectators go? Spectators ain't stupid. I mean, promoters think spectators are stupid, but they're not. When you advertise a Pro Stock, Nostalgia Pro Stock race, you better have a Nostalgia Pro Stock race. Just like when you advertise a gasser race, when that guy comes in a gate and plunks down $20, he's expecting to see a gasser race. Well, these promoters are lying to them. First off, go back to the word race. They're not coming to see a show. They're coming to see a race. This one group does some kind of Chicago-style match racing or some crap with these supposed gassers. I had a guy the other day call me, and he said, I went to see these such, and I won't call their name. I should. I won't call their name. But he said, I went and seen this gasser race the other day. They advertised gassers, blah, blah, blah. I went, and he starts telling me about how they was trying to run them. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, I'll just put it to you this way. It was like watching a ball game and nobody keeping score. He said, but they advertised a race. A race has got a winner at the end of the day. You know, anyway, that we, I'll get to this point and I'll hush. We don't worry about how many cars we have because we don't charge an entry fee to the cars. We don't charge entry fee to the crew. I have track operators say, I can't believe that. You, how you get by, that's where we make our money. I said, guess what? If a show sucks so bad, you got to charge a driver to get in, something's wrong. We don't have to charge a driver because we got this new thing that's come about called spectators. Your drag racing, except for you big races, have forgot about spectators. They don't even calculate that in anymore. The sound system, now I'm talking about ma and pa tracks. The sound system's a shambles. The bleachers are shambles. You know, they're all falling in. And I'll ask a track operator, you know, why don't you fix your bleachers up? Why don't you get your sound system fixed? Well, we don't have spectators no more, so we don't worry about it. The only people that come to watch a race is the family and crew of the racers. There's no real spectators walk through the gate. Well, now that has changed. We are bringing in spectators. And speaking of announcer, we bring our own announcer. Same guy, David Lancaster, goes to every race because he can tell the story because we have spectators. That's important now. You can take these big deals like you said you like to go to the Columbus thing there, the Hot Rod Reunion or whatever. You can take that big show that brings in 3,000 or 4,000 people, spectators I'm talking about, because remember there's probably 700 participants there. So participants and crew, you got 2,000 people there before the first spectator ever walks through the gate. So when they advertise 5,000 people here, only 3,000 of them are actual spectators. But you can take that show and choose any one group and take them somewhere by themselves, and they won't be 300 people show up. That's what we're proud of. We don't do tag-along shows. I've been called 3 different times over the course of the last 9 years, begged to come to California Hot, or not California, Bowling Green Hot Rod Reunion. Have no interest. We've been invited twice to Bristol NHRA national event with our show. I've turned them down both times. We don't do tag-along shows because we don't have to. We have a standalone show that brings in spectators. And I say show, and I shouldn't. It's a race. We don't have a show. We have a race. I've even used that advertised for, if you're looking for a show, you come in the wrong place. This is going to be a drag race.
Now, kind of going off of that, and, you know, my dad, you know, grew up around cars and racing, you know, back in the heyday, you know, the muscle car era. And, you know, I hear him talk about back, you know, when they had these different different classes and, you know, A gas, B gas, C gas, and so on. And some of our listeners might not necessarily know the difference, you know, kind of what goes into the differentiating these cars. And I,
you talking about the gassers?
Yeah. I've got a follow up to that. That, you know, are kind of a point I want to make, but I want you to kind of lay out there, you know, what is, you know, A gas, C gas, you know, B gas, C gas. What's it all about?
We do it just exactly like they did in the 60s. We classify the cars. There again, we're the only group in existence, successful group in existence that does this. We classify them by weight to cubic inch. A gas is 6 pounds per cubic inch. So let's just say you have a 400-inch engine. 6 times 400, 2,400 pounds, what the A-gas car's got to weigh. B-gas is 8 pounds per cubic inch. 400-inch engine, 4H is, what, 32, got to weigh 3,200 pounds. C-gas is 10 pounds per cubic inch. 400-inch engine, it's got to weigh 4,000 pounds. That's why the little engines are so popular, and that's why they were so popular back then. You know, A-gas had the big engines, just like our deal does. You see the big blocks and all in A-gas because it's only 6 pounds per cubic inch. When you get to C-gas, nobody wants a 4,000-pound car, so they build in 292s and 287s to get down around 2,900 pounds. And it there again, we're the only group in existence that has been successful at using a weight to cubic inch, because guess what that means? Now that means we got to have scales. We got to have a P&G tube to check cubic inches. We have to have a tech department to pull heads off and measure bore and stroke, be somebody gets protested. Racetracks don't have scales no more. They're there, but they ain't been used in 30 years because bracket racing come in, and when bracket racing took over, you don't need scales. So we had to build a set of portable scales, and we did a really cool deal. I mean, it's a trailer that goes in and transforms and sets down 5 inches off the ground. Now we have scales that go to every race with us. That's why nobody's copying us, because of all these little details they're not willing to do.
Now that we've set the table with A-gas, B-gas, and C-gas and that explanation, this is why I think people need to pay attention to this, and what makes it so important is that this, to me, is like, you know, it's the first true heads up racing where people had to really be smart about what they built to
exactly
be at the top of these classes. And it's
exactly,
it is literally what it's like the cornerstone of, you know, what Radial versus the World is now.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had to take a rule book and figure out, okay, I'm gonna run C gas. What is going to be the best combination? Okay, I'm going to run, you know, that 292 cubic inch engine.
Uh-huh.
Well, how the hell do I make that go fast? And that's where these innovators came in to figure out. You know, it's not like today where I could go online right now, and if I had a credit card with a $100,000 limit, I could build an 8-second car, no problem.
Exactly. No problem.
There was not that back then. It was, you know, Earl and Daryl's building a car to go C gas racing. Well, how am I going to make this thing fast? And they'd have to develop this on the fly. And to me, that's what makes this style of racing so interesting, is that you're resurrecting ancient practices to make them go fast.
Yep. And you're exactly right. We have people now, we've got engine builders now. We have our cylinder head rule, for example. You have to run stock valve angle heads. We don't allow the 11 degree, the 15 degree. We do allow you to angle mill the head to a 21 degree, which was done back in the day. That's the reason we allow it. And you would not believe what's going on with these stock style cylinder heads. We allow aluminum head, but it's got to be the stock valve angle. It's got to be the stock configuration on the outside. And these guys are sitting at home now, porting their own stuff and working on it, and then, of course, they're spending big money trying to get so-and-so to do it. You're exactly right, though. They have sat down and took, say, this guy's got a 55 Chevrolet. He knows the best he can do is get that car down to 2,800 pounds. We do it with the driver in the car. And so he knows if he's going to run C-gas or if he's going to run B-gas, he's got to divide that by 8 and see what cubic inch engine he needs to build and what's going to be his best combination for this car. And I got to touch on another subject right quick. It's the same thing. This is why it's not cookie cutter. That's why you don't – we have races where a big block and small blocks in the finals, and they go through the finish line an inch apart because of the weight to cubic inch thing. You remember when pro stock was at its exciting time? It was in 1970 to 1983. Lee Sheppard, Bob Glidden, Frank Iaconio. When pro stock was really, really, really pro stock, from 70 to about, it was weight to cubic inch.
Oh yeah.
When they went to the 500 inch, everybody runs 500 inch, and everybody weighs 2,350 pounds. At that day, it started becoming cookie cutter. It just took it this long to get there. But they killed it. Well, see, that's why this deal's so cool, and is because it's not cookie cutter. You got big block Fords. We found out the big block Ford couldn't compete. So we've took a half a pound off of it. If you run a big block Ford, it's in the rules. Big block Ford, 385 series block style, you get to weigh 5.5 pounds in 8 gas. We're constant, just like they did back then. They give different combinations. They would find that this combination won't do that. They let him do whatever. Racing's always been in that. and you keep a standard going. Big block Chevrolet, believe it or not, gets a quarter pound weight break. My big blocks were disappearing. People had figured out this big block won't run with a small block in a weight to cubic inch situation. So they started junking the big. I said, no, I don't want my big blocks to disappear. My racing will become cookie cutter. So I went in there that winter and I said, hey, we're taking a quarter pound off the big block Chevy. It's only got to weigh 5.75 or 7.75 in B gas. Guess what? People say, hey, that gives them some incentive to get back to work on the big block. Now they go through the finish line about an inch apart. And people are now going home and working on their race cars. Where before, the last 25 years, the race car stayed in the trailer all week. Just like you said, you go take $100,000, plunk it down, you can have an 8-second car. Don't fit no class, though. That car couldn't race with us because it's going to be all illegal. And we've got guys that's probably spent $100,000. But our B-Gas World Champion this year is a manager at a plumbing supply store. He don't have a bunch of money. It's because he works on his car every night. He does just like what they did in the 60s, and that's what's so cool about this. We're seeing everything come back. It's bringing it all back. Oh, and I'm telling you, you ain't seen nothing yet. You wait a couple more years because this thing, unless I have a stroke or a heart attack trying to make it happen, it's only getting better.
Well, I think
we got sponsors coming on board, which is fixing to really take off.
Well, I think that's what makes it cool is, you know, to me, it kind of brings to the surface like that American graffiti kind of feel where
Exactly. Everybody
want to beat Milner, you know, so they're going to
That's exactly right. And they go home and they work on their car. That's exactly right.
And it makes an interesting mixture of that old school drive with the new school technology because mm-hmm. someone like me would be like, all right, I got to figure this out. So they're going to go home and they're going to research and they're going to learn and they're going to figure out what can I do to make this car faster. And they're going to mm-hmm. tweak on it. And that's, you know, and even with, you know, they kind of draw a parallel to modern heads up cars, like, you know, and let's say, you know, I've crewed on a radial tire car X275.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even like dirt track cars, you're at the track for a small amount of time compared to the 25, 30 hours a week you're putting into that car before
exactly.
you go to the track to be successful. And that's what I think what roots true heads up racing, what makes this interesting is that you're doing that kind of stuff to tweak on this car and you look at everything and you analyze it like, what can I do to go faster? And what makes, you know, something like this racing interesting is that you don't have the technology crutch per se. You got to go old school to figure this out.
Yeah, we don't allow any kind of two-step. We don't allow clutchless shifting. Of course, the old school suspension. We don't allow coilover shocks. We don't allow but a single disc clutch. Like I said, the cylinder head rules are really strict. We give a 100-pound weight break. It's a 100-pound swing. If you use the old-style intakes, like the real old bread bot, you can do anything you want to the inside, but you can't change the outside appearance. So that's got people into challenges. You wouldn't believe what's going on with these intakes now because they get the weight break for running an old-style intake. It gives them an incentive to do it, so they went to work on it. You can't run the carburetor sideways. You have to run them straight. So that misaligns the carburetors with the ports. And now we got people just working inside these intakes trying to fix these little issues that created because the carburetors are not allowed to be in line. That didn't come along till the 70s. Sideways carburetors didn't. Wheelie bar. I've got off subject again, but I got to throw this in. One of the main things that I think people screw up with the gassers is the wheelie bar. The wrong wheelie bar, you can build the nicest gasser in the world and put the wrong wheelie bar on it. Well, to me, that looks like a run right in the middle of the door of a perfect paint job. The wheelie bar is another history lesson. You will remember back in the 60s and 70s, especially, they'd go take an old leaf spring, and they would go to the hardware store and buy a caster wheel and weld on the bottom of that leaf spring, and they would hang it under there for a wheelie bar. Well, as time went on, people got Don Harding, some of the guys building pro stockers. They copied that wheelie bar design, but they kept the wheel under the bottom of the plate. Let's say it's got a flat plate, but the wheel was under the bottom. Well, in about 1975 or 76, the back of the cars got lower, pro stockers. They were coming down in the back. Well, the wheelie bar started hitting the lower balance panel right under the bumper. So they come up with the idea of moving the wheel behind the plate, like your modern day wheelie bars are today. Well, my rules make you have that wheel under the plate. Simple things like that. That, because that didn't start. Now, you 99% of the gassers you see right now, probably 100% if they're not Southeast Gasser cars, will have the modern wheelie bar like you can order from Moroso. That's $350. They buy that wheelie bar and they poke it up on the back of the car, because that's the simple way to go now. And I think most people don't realize how goofy that looks on their car, to have that wheelie bar, have the wrong design wheelie bar on it. Now, you're going to start noticing that now, bet you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll start looking.
You're going to look and you're going to say, oh, my God, he's got a modern wheelie bar on that thing. But that wheel went from under the plate to behind the plate to gain room on the balance panel as the pro stockers got lower. But you never seen that in the 60s unless it was a big old wagon wheel or something hanging back there. But that's the little things we do to keep the like I said, the fans are not stupid, and they're noticing this kind of stuff. And we're making sure. I don't even need a tech department. The fans send me pictures after every race. If there's something wrong with somebody's car, you can bet. I got pictures emailed to me. Hey, we paid $20 to come see a gasser show. How come this guy's getting by with an altimeter tack in his car? Well, I just didn't catch it, or it wouldn't have been in there. And believe it or not, we even have rules of gauges. The V-cals on the cars, it can be a modern company, but it has to be the old school font. Like Hoosier, for example. We use Hoosier's modern decal, but you know why? Because it's the same decal they used in the early 70s. Believe it or not, they never changed it. NGK ain't changed their decal since 1936, I believe it is, or something. It's way back, might have been 56. Anyway, I'm off subject again. Take back over.
No worries. No, like this show is all about, like, I like the guests to tell the stories, because me spewing off hot takes would get old after about 2 minutes. So
yeah, but I get carried away and I get totally off the subject. We was on a whole different subject. I do want to touch back on something real quick. I don't want to give people the impression I don't like Nostalgia Pro Stock, because I do. I think it's a great idea. But I think they're falling victim to the same thing that all nostalgia groups are falling victim to. And if you hit the nail on the head, they're trying to get more cars. And they don't have an engine limit. You know, if they're going to do it, they need to do weight to cubic inch or something, so they can race these cars heads up, first finish line wins. And they're letting them run converters. I talked to Ricky Smith the other day about this. Well, I say the other day, it was about a year or so ago. And I just asked Ricky, I said, Ricky, I'm up on pro stock history, but I'm not real sure. I said, was a converter ever allowed in pro stock? He said, no, and still not today. So it wasn't even allowed. Not that nobody done it, like a lot of the controversy in the gasser world. You know, they can say, well, the rule book didn't say no, but we just went with what was most popular. But in pro stock, the converter's not even allowed, just like it wasn't in Pro Mod until the 2000s or so. And so Nostalgia Pro Stock definitely does not need to have a converter in it. But somehow or another, I think, now again, this is my opinion only, because I'd love to see that thing work. They need to do something to keep the cars even, where they can race them against each other in a heads-up format, first finish line wins. Wow. And I don't know how they can do it. It's going to be difficult. But they've fallen victim to the same thing. But I wanted to get that out there. I love Nostalgia Pro Stock, and I support it. I think it'll do great. But I'm watching it dwindle away. There are no spectators. You got to get the spectators. The thing's great. When you look at empty bleachers, something is wrong. We measure our success by how many people come through the gate. Not racers, not crew. How many spectators pay to come and watch our show? And I don't know any other way you measure success of any racing organization. The promoters measure success by how much money they made. I don't, because they're charging the racers.
Now,
we don't charge a racer.
Now, to kind of spin off that and change gears slightly here, you know, I'd like to get your take on some of the more modern things going on in drag racing, since you definitely, you know, old school people to me are good overall, I think, like the canary in the coal mine kind of deal. Example
right.
I give is, you know, my father-in-law was a veteran. I got married in a VFW. And going to the VFW, you see all the old school guys. And, you know,
right.
to me, that level of knowledge is something that's been attained over time. And kind of what's your take on, you know, kind of this the modern radio tire thing, the you know, radio versus the world, these heads up classes that, you know, basically took a radial tire and have, you know, they're going 350s on a radial tire. You know, is that something you ever thought you'd see?
No, and I'm very impressed by it. I'm impressed by what the cars are doing. I'm impressed by their performance. I'm impressed that it's got it's give the young kids, I'll call them young kids, but it's give people a chance to get back into heads up first to the finish line racing, because the tire's a limiting factor. The only thing I don't like about it is I don't like the fact that the tracks have to do special prep for them.
Oh, yeah.
They ought to have to run that tire on the standard racetrack. I know it'd be difficult, but to me, you're going in and asking a racetrack to do something special for your race. But other than that, I love the class. I think it's great, and it does exactly what you said earlier when you said exciting. That radial tire deal, these cars, you never know if they're going to pick the wheels up at the 330. You never know if they're going to go straight. They've come right back full circle to what Pro Mod was when it started, because the cars are unpredictable.
And you
just, so I love it, and I'm very impressed with what they're doing with that little bitty tire.
And you just said something there that to me also kind of pairs off that with no prep racing, is that I've talked to radial racers that have gone from, you know, radial, and they do some no prep racing, and they basically, you know, have said the same thing. All we're doing is taking a modern car, you know, like a radial versus the world car on a slick tire and trying to make it go down track prep from 20 years ago.
Yep, exactly.
What do you think
of
that?
And I like the no prep thing, but I don't understand it, because I've talked to some promoters and track operators. They are prepping. They're prepping the track. They're not racing on asphalt or concrete. There's a rubber base dam. So I've got to do more research before I can give my opinion on that, because I'm watching this deal, and I said, they've rubber on that track. Why are they calling it no prep? I think it's light prep is what they should be calling it.
There's different factions within it. Outlaw Armageddon is probably the biggest, like, single, like, standalone no prep event. And they go through and they scrape it down to as much as it can on the first around 60 to 100 feet down to bare track surface. Now,
Well, that I would agree with, yeah.
Now, here's what's interesting. Imagine from a racer's point of view, is a couple times to keep it interesting and, you know, to keep it as little prep as possible, they might, in the middle of a round, scrape it.
Oh, yeah, now that throws them by a curve.
You'll see them watching that, and then they got to go back and change that tune-up. And to me, when it comes to level of exciting, you know, there's some people that just, like, the atmosphere at that event reminds me a lot of, like, old-school NHRA races. You know, even back when, you know, John Force was my favorite driver, I make no bones about it. When people, you know, Force versus so-and-so, and they're cheering. When John did a burnout, they're going crazy. It's the same thing with these guys, and it doesn't have to be necessarily one of the guys from Street Outlaws. There's a lot of, like, guys that aren't on the TV show or aren't, like, stars, per se, that draw fan bases, and people ravenous about it. They go nuts, and it's so awesome to see.
I think it's bringing back racing. I'm not a Street Outlaw TV show fan, because I've tried to watch it and it insults my intelligence too bad. But I will say that I think that TV show has done good for the sport. It's gotten people back into the sport. And that, just like you said, now we're starting to see heroes out of our racers that weren't on the TV show. You know, back when I was running Pro Mod, we didn't have all that. We had good TV shows, but it wasn't, it was just the race, ESPN, TNN. I got a basement full of TV shows where they did on our races. They're all VHS stuff, of course. But that TV show has brought a lot of new fans to drag racing. And I'm glad to see now that fan base is moving on to the ones that ain't on TV.
Oh, yeah.
Like you just said, you're seeing stars from all these radio guys and no prep guys or whatever. But the only thing all of this is doing, if you think about what's happening here, and we go back to when we first started our conversation, the radio deal, the no prep deal, it's all putting some sort of talent back in the sport. And it's putting the driver back in the car. I did get a little discouraged the other day. I was over at one of my buddy's place, and he had a modern day iRadial or 10.5 car. I don't know the difference between a lot of them. But anyway, I'm looking on the front of it, and it's got this little sensor up there. And I said, "What's this all about?" And he said, "You don't want to know." And this was actually about a year ago. And I said, "What is it?" Well, see, I'm impressed because they wasn't running a wheelie bar. It's a daggone infrared that adjusts the timing to keep the car at a certain height going down a track. I'm like, "Oh, come on. You just busted my bubble." I'd rather never known that was there.
You know, with the wheelie sensors, it's a performance thing, but to me at the same time, knowing a lot of these racers, it's a safety thing.
There's no doubt it's a safety thing. I just assume they put wheelie bars back on them. Now some talent comes back to adjusting a wheelie bar and that sort of thing. But like I said, I'm just so old school. The little things like that will event, like I told you earlier, the race pack computer is what destroyed Pro Mod, because it started giving us information that made the cars go down the track too good. And I'm seeing the same thing. I'm seeing history repeat itself with technology now. In a class that used to be like the driver had to, whatever, and the tuner had to do to keep these things down, now all of a sudden there's an electronic device that does it.
What makes, you know, I think I'm old enough to respect the old school and see the old school stuff, but I'm also young enough that I get to see kind of technology fascinates me in racing.
The thing that I've noticed
is that you can buy technology, you can buy all these doodads you want, but if you do not know how to make them work, you just wasted a lot of money, plain and simple.
Oh yeah, there's a certain talent there. There's talent to using a computer. People say, "Oh, they took talent out of racing." Well, you know, and I'm the first one to say that. But oh yeah, it's talent to. That's why when I see somebody bash bracket racing, No. There's a special talent it takes to bracket race.
Oh, yeah,
it's just
totally.
Such a different thing. I try to not bash bracket racing because I think it takes a special talent to do it. And when you hear me say something about bracket racing, it's because they didn't bracket race in the 60s, so that don't fit our program. And I hate to see other gasser groups doing it because they're saying they're racing like they did in the 60s when they're lying to the fans. And the same thing today, I just hate to see the technology taking over. But that's the world today. Everybody's got an iPhone now. Everybody's got a computer. We promote our 1960s drag racing on a computer now. So there is definitely some talent, like you said, that it takes to use that sensor. There was technology in Pro Mod when I quit. We had the timing retards, and we had the arc module where we could draw a line of how we wanted the drive shaft to do, but you had to know how to draw that line. You had to know how to do it.
Well, Quain, our time here on the Drag Zine podcast is coming to an end, and I like to give my guests their chance to do their best John Force impersonation and rattle off their sponsors and where they can be found at. So I'll turn the floor over to you so you can tell people where they can find information about the Southeast Gassers and what you guys got going on.
Well, I'll start by saying be sure if you decide to go see a gasser race that you make sure it's a Southeast Gasser race. There's, like I said earlier in the interview, there's 35 different things. And I want to say this. I probably get 20 a week messages or phone calls from people that went to a gasser race and and was very, very, very disappointed because they had heard about how the gasser craze is coming around. Oh, we kept hearing gasser, 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 so we went to a gasser race, and we was very disappointed. Never planned on going to another one until some of our buddies kept on and on, no, you got to try the Southeast gassers. Then they called me and say, thank God, we was talked into going. I'm worried about how many people don't get talked into giving us a chance. When they've seen a so-called gasser race or so-called nostalgia race, I'll throw the whole bunch in there, and they were disappointed in the cars not being like they should have been and the racing not being like it should have been, please give the Southeast gassers one chance. Watch our videos. Do something. But you can get your information at southeastgassers.com. And they you can go there, you can see our rules, you can see our schedule, which we're about a quarter done with the 220 schedule. And you can get all the information. My phone number's there, my email address is there. I can be personally talked to if you're wanting to build a car, or if you're I was going to say if you want to book a race. Well, that's not going to happen because we have 11 races a year, counting those tracks. We have, not counting those tracks, I'm sorry, not counting those tracks, we have 22 racetracks on the waiting list right now for our show. How long has it been since you heard that? 22 racetracks on a waiting list because we have, like I told you earlier, we bring in this new thing called spectators. And so the tracks want that. And I have to warn people that there's so many copycat groups out there now that's trying to do this, but they're not, they're doing it the easy route. They're taking the easy road. And when you go see the race, you're never probably going to go to another one. They're proof of it. They'll have 300 or 400 people at one race and then 50 people at the next one. Well, the people don't come back. Well, we gain every race. My sponsors, CPM, which is, you may remember the old Pro Mod racer, Steve Vick, raced Pro Mod for about as many years as I did. Steve has been really, really good to me. He's put a lot of money in this deal. He owns Carolina Precision Machine. Hoosier Tire has followed me from Pro Mod right on over here. They've been really, really good to us. They even actually built the spec tire for our super stock car because nobody built a tire like we needed for this true super stock class. So Hoosier spent bukus of money for a mold just to build us a tire. So obviously they think we have a future. They wouldn't have done that. Summit Racing Equipment has been good to us. We expect them to do more, to come back next year. We're looking for some big things to happen there. I could go on forever with the sponsor stuff. White Safety. Carl White at White Safety. Ram Clutches. Ram's been with me since the get-go. They're again followed me over from Pro Mod. I hate naming sponsors because I always forget somebody. The AMSOIL helps us. We just have tons and tons of help. And all these people are helping us because they see this thing has a future and they want to be a part of it. So anybody that wants to get involved, we're here. Like I say, go to southeastgassers.com and my phone number, my email address. If I said something on this show that offends you, call me and bless me out. I don't care. I hear it every day anyway. Believe me, the other gasser groups hate us because we are showing the fans what they should be. And they truly hate us. I get hate mail from the other gasser groups because, oh, you're ruining it for everybody, you know. And, well, we're not. We're trying to show what it was. And I don't down them. I just tell them what we do. We race first and the finish line wins. And I don't, like I say, as far as I know, none of the rest of them do. Not in a format, not in an elimination-style format anyway. But I'm done. I could talk all day about it, but I know people ain't going to listen, probably already went over my limit. So I really appreciate you calling me and letting me get involved. And anytime I can help, just give me a holler.
Well, Clayne, thank you for coming on the show, and we look forward to seeing you out at the track this year.
You bet, man, and thanks so much for having me, and I hope I didn't bore you too bad.
Oh, no, you're fine, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks to Quain for stopping by. And as always, may your reaction times be crisp and your win lights bright. And additionally, have a great Thanksgiving this week, folks. Thanks.